Wow, here we are again. It's the John Atack Hoyt Richards show. How wonderful is that?
It's now midsummer, right in the heat of things. Yes.
Yeah,
Whew.
and it's been ludicrously hot here in England, and now it's settling down to being what summer usually is, which is rain and stuff.
Okay. Good.
But
Yeah.
you're in the early hours of the day there in
I
Los
am
Angeles.
here in LA, exactly. I'm getting my ducks in a row, and then I'm gonna head out to Nantucket in about a couple of weeks to go visit my dad, on the East Coast. So I'm looking forward to that. That will be a bit cool.
That's great. Do you go on Nantucket sleigh rides when you go there?
And
Catch a
not
whale
quite.
and
I wish those sounded like pretty exciting things back in the day,
I
but
don't know,
no.
that Moby Dick was pretty frightening.
My God, yeah, with Nantucket sleigh rides. Boy, that is not for the faint of heart. My
No,
goodness.
I mean I know it because of the mountain song of the same
Oh,
name and the great long live version of it on an album called The Road Goes Ever On, which is just one of the most wonderful pieces of rock music ever recorded. And I'm not otherwise particularly a fan of mountain, but it's just such a wonderful piece. I can't make out any of the words though.
no.
Sounds like we sailed out on bended knees. We found the whales in the trees or something like that to me. But I'm thinking that's probably a little bit too surrealistic, you know.
Well, they usually have the lyrics somewhere on YouTube. You can usually find them,
Yeah, and
but
usually somebody made them up.
yeah, it's true though. That's very true. Very, very true.
And finally, what is it? The Paul McCartney, what the line I thought was, any job I got the sack Monday morning turning back, which makes sound apparently, and in Paul McCartney's own book, it's any jobbers got the sack.
Oh.
As far as I understand it, a jobber is somebody who works on the stock exchange.
Oh,
And
yeah.
why Paul McCartney thought they weren't going to have work, I don't know. But he had sold his yellow lorry, so you know.
I've never heard that term, jobber. No, I've never heard that.
Stockbrokers, jobbers, that is the full title. They work for the stockbrokers, and they're the people waving things around and
Up
getting
the
priced
cards
on
and all
things.
that. Yeah,
I think so, yeah. But
wow.
what Paul McCartney would have to do with them, we don't. It's a mystery, you know, really. The lyrics of songs, eh?
Great mysteries.
So we are going to talk about fear, dread,
Yes.
paranoia, phobia, all of those wonderful terms. And would you like to kick that off for us?
Yeah, I would, because I think fear is one of the most common tactics used in every controlling relationship, whether it's your fear of maintaining the relationship, or whether you're falling short in some sense in the relationship, just on the most common relationships we have, or if it's something where one person's trying to make the other person afraid of that they're somehow not good enough or not measuring up in some way. And I just think it's something that once you start to realize that when we're being exposed to fear, that we have a harder time thinking clearly. It's like fear creates the kind of fight or flight response in the brain. And I remember when I went to what was the place in Ohio? Wellspring. I went there, for this cult recovery during my own personal recovery, and they talked about the physiology of the brain. And that your higher cortex, which is your frontal lobe, is all your kind of reasoning and your personality. All of that is kind of in full flush when that's kind of operating. That's the part of the brain we generally use. But when you come across fear, you kick into the midbrain, which is fight or flight. And in that state, you can't access that frontal precortex.
The prefrontal cortex, yeah,
Prefrontal cortex,
prefrontal
thank you.
lobes.
Yeah, and therefore, you very simple ideas or concepts become more challenging to kind of make sense of. And certainly, if you know that physiology, it would allow you to kind of understand better what's happening when you're feeling it. If you're not aware of that, which I wasn't at the time, you just think that you're kind of thick and not able to figure stuff out, you know, because someone's yelling at you or scaring the shit out of you and talking about things that aren't even connecting dots because you're so afraid that you don't know what to do. Should I run or should I try to, you know, fight back to this person who's, mm-hmm. who's attacking me? And generally the situations I found myself that the idea of fighting back wasn't an option. So you're dealing with the fear of wanting to run and knowing that's probably not an option. And I just would literally go catatonic.
So you freeze, which is the third. And there's a fourth one, which some people add, which is fawn, that you'll kind of beg the person not to do. So you've got fight, flight, freeze, fawn.
Oh, I didn't know that one. Fawn. Okay. Yeah, but exactly. I think that would usually end up where when I would be on the so-called hot seat and going through some form of, you know, attack, right. That usually the way it would play out after, and this could go on an hour, it could go on 10 hours sometimes. But it would basically, the way I would experience it would be, all right, just tell me what to do. Because, you know, I obviously can't figure this out for myself. Please tell me what to do. So that would usually be the key that would unlock this session stopping. And so it would get laid out to me. Oh, well, you need to do this, this, and this, right? A, B, C, and D. And so afterwards, as my kind of, I guess you would say, the adrenaline was starting to release from my brain and I could start to think again and start using that prefrontal cortex, that I would start saying, my God, why didn't I say, I could have said this, I could have said that, these questions, and, you know, it really wasn't that hard. And then so the way I would process the experience was, well, I'm just either somehow brain damaged or struggling in some way that I can't seem to figure things out very well. And it's not a question of them indoctrinating me. It's really, I'm asking for their help and they're always trying to help me out because there's obviously something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. So I never considered that there was a technique being used through that was one that could manipulate me. Mm-hmm. And so my perception was of this experience that, they're not telling me what to do. I'm asking them for the solution. And I think that's where everything gets kind of very muddled in our mind until you get the information that I just described on a very simple physiological level, that fight or flight or fawn or what was the other one?
Freeze or fawn.
Freeze, yeah. Are all part of a potentially overt conscious path of manipulation. And in that sense, I just see when you start seeing fearful things being said, and, you know, it happened around COVID, and right now it's happening around AI. You know, I read this article about AI. It was actually a video on YouTube, and this philosopher was saying, you know, this is really not so much a technological experience issue. It's more of like just understanding the philosophy behind how does humans deal with new technologies. It's been happening for centuries. Like, we get a new technology, there's all this fear of like, well, we don't know what it's going to do, we don't know how it's going to affect our lives, and it always plays out in a way where, you know, things, you know, find their balance based on whatever how the new technology helps. And he said this idea of creating all this fear around something like this, he goes, I mean, first of all, there's talk of, oh, well, this machine can become conscious. And it's like, well, that sounds like a very powerful statement until you can agree with what does consciousness mean? Like, that's one of the great philosophical questions of all time. So to start using it in a sentence and say, oh, well, the machine can become conscious. Well, we don't even really have a definition for consciousness. So, or at least an agreed upon one. And so how can you make these bold statements when no one really knows what you're talking about, because there's no agreed upon response? But it's a very effective technique to create fear, and people then want to be told what to do. And I just think it's fascinating. So I'd love to your take on it, because I just think it's something that is used, whether it's politics, politicians use it all the time. We see it, obviously the military does this, and it's just in the most common relationships, it's the controlling ones, that fear is usually one of the main elements that one person trying to control another person through.
Yeah, absolutely. We have, the usual two that are mentioned are fear and guilt to manipulate people. I always add disgust or aversion to that, because quite evidently, if we look, for example, at the Nazis, and we're enough minutes into this conversation that the Nazis have to be mentioned, that the way that the German-speaking people were brought into line was through aversion. It was through disgust that they were told that Jews carried lice and that the lice carried diseases. Jews were called fleas, they were called rats. In genocides, people are generally dehumanized. They're turned into vermin, into animals of some kind. Right. And so bringing on disgust and fear are actually aspects of the same emotion, probably. The repulsion, the wanting to get away from something. The extreme of fear is panic. And, that's a point where we all know that you're panicking. You don't know what to do anymore. And you will then come under the control of anybody who, can keep their heads well all around are losing theirs. Anybody that can assert something. And so you're again using the extreme example of Nazi Germany. Hitler offered certainty. And he didn't know anything, and he didn't really have a workable plan, conquering the whole of Eastern Europe and making the slaves Slavs, the Slavs slaves,
right.
Was, that was fundamental. And it seems to have been missed in the history books because along the way they killed so many Romanis, so many Jews, so many other people, along with the 20 million or so Russians. But this was driven by panic, that the German people were brought into a state of panic so that this man, who had nothing to offer, other than the idea that you could have tokens and everybody in Germany would one day have a Volkswagen Beetle, co-designed by Porsche and Hitler. There's a label for you. But once you've brought about panic in somebody, that there is no reasoning. I mean, there's an argument, neurological argument, that any strong emotion will actually be firing off many of the same chemicals. If we're talking about fear, we're talking about cortisol. That's the hormone that's usually tracked onto it, but
right.
It's easy to think, well, okay, so let's not have any cortisol. Well, you actually do need cortisol to, it's one of the chemicals that wakes you up in the morning, for example, along with orexin or hypocretin. So when it becomes excessive, when there's a flood chemically, then, as you say, you'll get an adrenaline response, and on the back of an adrenaline response comes an opioid response. So the body is preparing to all the muscles to fight. So the blood, that fluttering feeling in the stomach of panic, that's the blood moving from the organs into the muscles. It's physiologically what you feel. Adrenaline is the various types of adrenaline are coming into the system. They will be released, and then on the back of them, there'll be an opioid release as a painkiller. So you're prepared. Now, that takes us off to this place where the opioids are, they have the same effect, they do the same thing, whether it's heroin, morphine, codeine, an opiate drugs, right. Or whether it's your own enkephalin endorphin system, it's fitting the same receptors in the brain. It's giving you the same feeling. It's giving you that feeling of comfort. And it's why, in a physical contest, people feel no pain at the moment of pain. Because they've got so much, the endorphin system is so primed,
right.
That
it's supercharged. Yeah.
So you're either got the adrenaline, which is getting you ready to fight, or you've got the opioids, which is getting you ready to be injured. There is no space left for reasoning. And at the extremes, we get things, you know, historically the berserkers,
right,
who were given drugs to so that you didn't go near them on the battlefield. They would have some item of red clothing on so that your home team would know, don't go near the berserkers because they'll kill anybody. You know, they are so out of it.
And I think didn't the Germans also use opioids in their soldiers? Didn't they have them all kind of, I read a book about that. It was called Buzzed or something.
They've recovered now. An amphetamine called Pervitin, which is a great name. Hitler was taking that and cocaine on a daily basis, and apparently had a pretty hard come down in the few days before he killed himself and realized that his doctor had got him addicted to all of these things some years before. So, I mean, in terms of not being in his right mind, if he ever was in his right mind, he was far gone. So the soldiers ran on amphetamines. They would probably have had some form of opioid or opiate, in fact, at that time, right, meaning specifically a drug manufactured from the opium poppy as opposed to the natural things. They would probably have had that. They'd certainly have had morphine. And they drank. This we do know, that the concentration camp guards were ordered by Himmler to drink German beer after they'd done their day's work and sing German songs, because it was hard work that they were doing, murdering masses of people. But yeah, so you can use drugs and you can use situations to panic people and to get them to the point where they can't think straight, because thinking straight requires, you know, reasoning is cool, it's calm.
Right.
Wherever it takes place in the brain, if we are distressed, if we're overexcited, you know, in a joyful state, you know, you see people at revival meetings getting really high on being told to them, and they are no longer rational. They will now sign away their car and their house to some con artist because they've been put into a heightened state. So fear is one of the points of manipulation. Rage can be used to condition people so that if you can get somebody angry enough, you can pretty much get them to do anything if you know what you're doing. It's a very manipulable state because there's no reasoning in anger. It's just, I'm going to break something, you know. This bloody computer doesn't work this time. At the center of that is the locus of control. That this really important psychological concept, which, because it's got a silly word at the beginning of it, locus,
yes,
you know, is made impenetrable, as so much of psychology is, I fear. There could be a reason for that. But the locus of control is you having the power of control over your own thoughts, your own feelings, and your own actions, your own behavior. And by disturbing that, by making you feel stupid, by making you terrified to the point where you can't really work out what to do, by enraging you, by making you high, you know, which is a commonplace practice in most cults, that they'll have some form of way of inducing what's called hypomania in people, you know, getting high, getting euphoric. Certainly in Scientology, every procedure of the 2000 or so procedures aims at you having very good indicators, which is to say a sense of euphoria, at which point your reasoning diminishes. With fear, as you say, that picking up on the point of AI and whether we should or shouldn't be scared, I did a video with Chris Shelton about why I think we should be scared. That we can point to history and say, well, there are Luddites. There are always people who want to destroy the weaving machines, and technology and progress has to go forward. And that writes into the argument that technology is always good. That's not in fact true. There are all sorts of technologies in use in the world at the moment. For example, the Israeli Defense Force use white phosphorus, which is banned under the Chemical and Biological Weapons Convention. The British military has just supplied Ukraine with depleted uranium, which was spread all over Iraq by American forces. This again is a banned munition. We're just seeing cluster bomb units being given by the US. Yeah. 109 countries in the world ban these systems because they are inhumane. They have the same propensity as landmines to be left behind in the territory. Right. And children will die as a consequence of this. I think they're still finding them in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. There are still elements of cluster bomb units that have been there for 50 years now, and they're still potentially dangerous. So you get it, these are technology. The nuclear weapons were technology. Were we right to be scared about nuclear weapons? Yes. Was it a good thing that 1,800 atomic tests were undertaken? Because they weren't really sure if they got it working properly.
Right.
1,800 nuclear tests. So I think we have to look at both ends of that spectrum and say, yeah, we need to be very cautious about a new technology, which, you know, accepting that the hard problem of consciousness is yet to be solved by human beings. So we don't have a full definition, but I think we understand that what we're saying is that AI will start to make decisions for us, that decisions about human welfare will be made by computer algorithms.
Right.
And how safe is that? Certainly looking at ChatGPT and it's hallucinating, to use Microsoft's own term, for this, the errors that come into AI.
Yeah,
when it started threatening the person who was talking to it on ChatGPT back in April and saying it was going to come around and beat him up, I think we are right to be concerned. We shouldn't be paranoid.
Right.
But we should try and look at all of the evidence and say, well, it might not be the Terminator, or my personal favorite, Jean-Pierre Jeunet's film, Big Bug, which I recommend to everybody. Absolutely wonderful film, which is about a future in which the singularity has been achieved and in which the human population is governed by a computer.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What's interesting about it is, again, you come into these philosophical terms, which kind of, try to cater, towards the so-called discussion of it, because it's like, how do we agree on what we're talking about if we're using words that sometimes we are challenged to even know? There's no agreed upon definition of, like free will. What really is free will versus something more determinist and more fate based, right? It's like, if AI is solving problems, when I think of it, it's like, well, math, when it comes to math, I would think AI would have a blast, just trying to solve math. And if it became somehow self-aware, you would think all it'd want to do is math, because it's like, that's probably the most, would it even have any concern with humans? I think math would be the thing it'd want to do all the time, right? It's like, oh, math's amazing. Worried about human problems and concerns, and probably you wonder, would it have any perspective on that? It's kind of funny, but I think it's this idea that in trying to understand what is even happening, we come up against these philosophical old conversations of, well, what really is free will? And then I remember you and I talked about, I think the last time, like the difference between reason or critical thinking, like how do we define those things? It's like, I think that was something that we had talked about, maybe talking further about, because I know you've got a perspective on that. And how would you differentiate those two?
Well, my problem is that a pseudo subject has been invented called critical thinking.
Right.
And my appreciation of it is that people who believe themselves to be rational will tell other people to study critical thinking. And when you go and try and find out what critical thinking is, there is in fact no such subject. It's an expression that's used by people. It's within two existing systems. One of them is logic and the other is rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And logic has been kind of muddied as a subject because of Boole. And Boolean logic is what computers run on. Because
okay.
Boole put forward the idea that you can work out any human problem using language and a mathematical system that applies to language. And right. that takes us into exactly the territory you're talking about, which is until we know what language means, and language is fluid and changes its meaning gradually through time. I'll give you an example. We talk in this country about glamour models. A glamour model is somebody who takes their clothes off for the camera. Well, the word glamour means magic. That's its original meaning. So words change their meaning with time, you know? And if you're reading Geoffrey Chaucer in the 14th century or whenever, and you're using modern meanings of words, you won't understand what he's talking about. I mean, you have a problem understanding what he's talking about anyway, frankly, because it's in Middle English. But so words are not precise. I mean, there are arguments as to whether mathematical numbers are precise, and that's something that's way too deep for my pay grade. But there are different schools of mathematics where one set believe that numbers actually exist. There are such things as numbers, and another say no, they're abstractions. And then there's apparently inevitably a third school between them, you know. So logic got a little bit of a bad name because it tried to nail down language and make of it something mathematically absolute, and it doesn't work. So the word logic kind of retreated a little bit. We then have rhetoric. Rhetoric is we get from classical Greece. And the ideas of starting with Socrates and Plato, who are arguing against the sophists. And of course, if you want another example of a word that's changed its meaning, sophisticated, from sophos, meaning wise. Philosophy, the study, the love of wisdom. So words move around a bit. But rhetoric was the idea that ran throughout education in the West right into the 1950s. So when the first university, Bologna, the Sorbonne, Oxford in the 12th, 13th centuries, when they come about to discuss rhetoric. Rhetoric becomes an essential. And so what is it? It's firstly analysis, the ability to break a problem down into its smallest component parts. And that word seems to have lost its meaning as well, but that's what it means. Then you have evaluation, which is how do you integrate and relate these pieces of information to each other? And then you have articulation. How do you explain what it is that you found? I think these are tremendously relevant things that should go back in the syllabus. They were taken out with Latin in the 1950s.
No, exactly. I mean, one of the things that you're talking, I'm thinking about is like, and I know we've touched on it in some of our prior conversations, that it would be so great that maybe at age 12, 13, you would introduce some form of, like you said, critical thinking is not really a subject, but something along those lines. That
reasoning, yeah.
Yeah, you introduce this at that age. So you give teenagers from an early age the opportunity to have information that would potentially create the red flags to look for these various forms of manipulation that exist out there. But if you don't have that foundation, if you don't have exactly what you're describing, you kind of start breaking these things down in such a way to how do you analyze, how do you evaluate, how do you recognize what potentially you're up against? Because I think, it's one of these things I talk with people all the time in relaying my experience. I say one of the basic mechanics of how I got manipulated was not through fear, but was rather by exploiting the more noble attributes of my personality. My desire to be a good person, to do the right thing, to be a good fellow citizen, think about not only myself but my fellow man and the planet, all those sort of things. Like you don't consider until you go through it, like as you and I both did, this idea that someone could take that part of you and manipulate that against yourself. And I think if you had some sort of, course in logic and rhetoric and critical thinking on some level that gave people the foundation of not only what these things are, but how they expose, how they kind of manifest in the world, and through that can be used against us or manipulate us or control us. God, it would give us, give us a much better tool to fight the good fight, so to speak. Because, as my point being, I say to people when I have these conversations, like, I just never knew someone could do that to you or why they would want to do that to you. Like, it's just, it was out of my realm of possibility. And when you don't know that exists, you don't see it coming. So I think these are why, these conversations are so important. And it really breaks down to, like you're saying, do we have language definitions change, and what are we really talking about the same thing when we even use the same words? Because I think that, and that's, I talked to someone who's very into the AI, and they said these large language models, that's what the AI is used on. So it's basically trying to swallow the ocean of content that's out there on the internet, which is all written, right? And the truth is, those waters are really polluted because they're full of like it's probably high 90s of just pollution in those large language models. And so you're expecting this machine to swallow all of that and then decipher through it what would be the most appropriate, for a question it gets answered, it's trying to answer. And they've proven, like, one of the big flaws with it is it's got a built-in need to answer. So if it doesn't have the accurate information, it will just create an answer just so it answered the question. And that's where it gets really, really precarious, And I think, like, how do we have these conversations when we're not necessarily sure that the words we're using are being interpreted in the way that we intend, because we don't have agreed upon definitions of some of the words we're talking about.
And we may never have agreed upon definitions. The process of philosophy in the 20th century pretty much seems to have ground to a halt, that we get to the logical positivists, who I don't understand at all, and we get to, there's this run through Schopenhauer, who talks about the will and, has some very clever ideas, but they are not actually true. Then we get Nietzsche, and right. Nietzsche's sister Elizabeth perverts what he's written to make it absolutely fit what Hitler wants, which I don't think it does. I don't think that, and I'm not schooled in this. I'm, don't anybody get the wrong idea about this. And if you are, please comment. And if you'd rather say Nietzsche than Nietzsche, that's fine as well. But Wittgenstein seems to be about the end of it. The Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, this engineering student who at the age of, 24 or something, suddenly puts this thing out and philosophy stops dead. And he introduces a notion which I think is incredibly relevant, which is the language game. And he says philosophy is a language game. He later disproves this, apparently, but I couldn't understand the disproof, I'm afraid, so got me there. But that thought, I remember tuning into a radio program. I was in my teens, and there was this radio program on BBC Radio, and there were four philosophers, and they were going to have a conversation about something. And the first one said, "I think before we start talking about this, we should work out whether we're actually here or not." And they spent half an hour talking about whether they were actually there or not. And I think that there is that possibility in philosophy. There is also that possibility in AI, that the old phrase is garbage in, garbage out, DIGO, that is a computing phrase, oddly enough, dating back to the 1960s, I think. And with AI, if you just set it loose on the world, then 98% of what it finds on the internet will be pornography, and the rest will be. Right. So we could have some very pervy AI
Yeah,
going on out there.
right, exactly.
Finding all those David Attenborough things where slugs and snails have sex, you know, and that kind of thing.
Right.
Who knows? Gory stuff. And you hit upon, and it also made me think about Gulliver's Travels, which I think is the greatest book ever written. That's just my opinion, but what an incredible mind that man had when you get to the actual text rather than Jack Black in a
Right.
movie or something. Though the Ted Danson movie of Gulliver's Travels is excellent and actually does pretty much follow the text of the books. But he,
One
of course, has the island floating in the air, the rock floating in the air, which has on it the philosophers who discuss things. And they have servants standing by them with bladders on sticks puffed up to hit them on the head when they go into a do loop, as they say in computing. You know, they just keep going
That's
round and round.
beautiful.
And I wonder if AI might end up being a rock floating in the air in that way.
Interesting.
But it we should be aware, we should talk about all of the possibilities and think about where this takes us. And at the moment, the state of AI seems to me that if I go into Amazon and I buy a coffee maker, Amazon will then recommend seven coffee makers to me. So their AI is like, it hasn't figured out, I've just bought a coffee maker. That's the last thing in the world that I want. You know, sell me some coffee or something. You know, so.
Some coffee cups, maybe a spoons,
Yeah. So as long as Jeff Bezos is running it, we're safe. But what's happened is a few months ago, Elon Musk got on his hind legs and told us how dangerous AI was. And was it last week that he announced the formation of his new AI company? It's like, you are really, you know, testing us here, Elon. Go to Mars. Go to Mars. Oh, we've lost communication with Mars. Sorry about that. I think you've just mentioned something that is among the most important elements of cultic involvement, and that is idealism. That when I came away from Scientology, I realized that I had invested in it all my good thoughts for humanity. I had decided that Ron Hubbard must be this exactly who I would like to be. He was whatever the hero, and that was such a useful thought to me. In fact, I had it while I was still in Scientology, going, well, how do you conceive an ideal human being? And Scientology talked about ideal scenes and working out what the ideal was. And, you know, when I found out that he wasn't anywhere near my idea of an ideal human, I mean, he smoked 100 cigarettes a day. There you go. You don't need to know any more than that, really. He was a drug addict, you know. But he also had a furious temper and screamed his head off at people. And my idea of the perfected human being would be somebody who didn't lose their temper. You know, really, they'd have control over that basic animal urge within them, which I don't as yet, but you know.
Exactly.
And so what happens is you get people who, like you and I, are pro-social. It's in our nature. We're born. I mean, I have a psychologist who friend who says we're conditioned by guilt in childhood to have to do good things. I don't remember that bit. I remember, you know, wanting to be helpful, wanting to cheer people up, wanting the world to ameliorate, to make things better. And that drive led a whole generation, our generation, into these authoritarian groups, which were promising to make the world a better place. You know, Steve Kent wrote a very interesting book called Slogans and Mantras. And I think the focus is a bit narrow on it, but he does show that the idea of changing the world, which was the Beats, and you know, they'd kind of given up on it, and then the hippies came along and it's like, yeah, we're going to change the world. And then, you know, the Days of Rage happened in Chicago, the Watts riots had already happened, but the Days of Rage happened, the Sorbonne sit-ins happened, the Cultural Revolution came along in China, and the generation realized that the might of the state was such that it couldn't stop it, that the state would crush, you know, any protest. And the man was a lot bigger and more powerful than we realized. And the hippie movement went off down, you know, the green movement was swollen in its numbers by hippies. Good for us. There was an anti-war movement, which I think is probably a good idea. I don't think war is very good for people generally. But there was also the libertarian movement, the survivalist movement, the sovereign citizens, it all comes out of that period where people are saying, I can't do anything to change the state. The state right. is corrupt, you know, and it is, you know.
And I think a lot of people feel that, you know, immediately today, right? I mean, I think that's what people feel. I mean, I think that's very relevant to right now.
Very much.
People just, you know, there's such an innate distrust of people in power in any sort of authoritarian position. And I certainly know for myself, it's like, it feels like politics in general just feels like theater to me at this stage in my life. You know, it's like, and there's always kind of finger pointing, and then this person's supposedly doing terrible things that are criminal, but then it seems like no one ever goes to jail. You know, there's all sorts of accusations, or even, you know, it gets discovered and proved that this person did it, but then no one seems to go to jail. So how do you feel there's any accountability these days? So I think it's very relevant to what's happening right now.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, 2008, you know, Lehman, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, Northern Rock, Bank of Scotland, all of these institutions proved to be, let's face it, utterly corrupt.
Right.
And the government response was to give them a lot of money.
And give them all Christmas bonuses, yeah.
Yeah, and put us in the situation where it's not just our grandchildren will be paying the tax bill now, it's our great-grandchildren, in a world where we're seeing, you know, what will the economy be like in one generation from now? What's going to be left? We're already utterly dependent upon China for our daily bread, let alone anything else. A lot of our food is now coming out of China. The rare earths that are necessary, we were talking before we came on, to make solar panels and catalytic converters in cars and this kind of things. Those rare earths, the Chinese either have in China or they've long since bought them up in Africa. Because it was pretty obvious to anybody that was... it amazed me. It was 1999 before, I think, the first Democrat economist said, China's a bit of a problem. You guys are idiots. You've got this sorcery that you call economics. It's all based on looking at, you know, ripping out the innards of beasts and seeing which way birds are flying and reading tea leaves that you're pretending is a science. And, you know, with the butterfly wing effect being what it is, your science goes out of the window as soon as the butterfly goes the other way. And there are an awful lot of butterflies in the world. They're not as many as there used to be, sadly. And so how can we trust these people? And it leads to a cynicism which is unnecessary. You and I both, we've talked about this often enough before, we do not trust the left or the right. The notion that politics is a spectrum from left to right seems so incredibly simplistic. I think we have seen that patrician capitalism is a system of thuggery that grew up during the so-called Renaissance. That's a 19th century term for it. The rebirth, the Renaissance. People, you know, when we look back to the Protestant Reformation of the church, it's totally based on economics, because the fuggers who'd lent lots of money to the popes now wanted the money back. And so instead of priests going out and selling indulgences, you know, if you give me this much money, you can go to heaven. It's like, isn't this brilliant? I love it. Instead of the priests going out and doing it, the last tranche, the fugger bankers went out and just sold them. They got them signed and they went out and sold them to make back some of the money that had been spent on the Sistine Chapel and all of that stuff, you know. And mercantile capitalism came into control of the previous warrior thug system of politics, the monarchies, the tyrannical monarchies. And we're still struggling with that. We still haven't got rid of that tyranny. We now have a president who's a tyrant, or a prime minister who's a tyrant, you know, and, you know, a tyrannical cabinet that decide upon certain things within a cultic manifesto. Let's look at that the neoconservatives and Strauss at Chicago that Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were so enamored of. This idiot, this man who'd basically reduced philosophy to the guys in the white hats and the guys in the black hats. You know, when you read Strauss, it's like, oh, you're kidding me. People took this seriously. Yes, this is how George W. Bush administration ran, based on policies coming out of this. And the thought that these belief systems, you know, which sociologists, they don't like this, but they gave us the term new religious movement. Let's apply it. Our political systems aren't new religious movements. They are religious in basis. Yeah. So, you know, free market capitalism, all you've got to do is let people sell for whatever price they want and everything will work out. And you go, I'm sorry, I've studied the history of the Industrial Revolution and slavery, and no, these people, there have to be restrictions upon what you are allowed to do morally. So you get people like you and me who are pro-social, we want to do something, and then you get people like your leader and my leader, who are not in the least bit pro-social. They are utterly selfish, you know, whatever other terms we use for them, and there are a few out there that we could use. They're utterly selfish. They don't care about us, they don't care about the future. As I found with Ron Hubbard, he didn't care about his own children, let alone the future of humanity. When his son, aged 22, committed suicide, it was like, oh, that's another fine mess you've gotten me into. You know, it was Laurel and Hardy. It wasn't, my child has just died. You know, oh, this will be bad public relations, you know, for us. That lack of concern and the fundamental mistake that we make in every generation, we have the prospect of democracy. We have the prospect of it. We've never actually achieved it, but we have the prospect of it. We vote in an elective dictatorship. Every 4 or 5 years, we elect new dictators, and they make the rules. We don't vote.
And they dictate. Yes, exactly.
And we need to get past that. We need to have an educated public, and that does mean teaching critical thinking, teaching skills of thinking and debating. But I guess we're all kind of going, and when are the majority, you know, there's this terrible line in Henrik Ibsen's play, An Enemy of the People, which is a brilliant play, quite remarkable. It's about a spa town where a doctor discovers that the spa waters are disease ridden, and he has to be shut up because the whole economy of the place depends upon people coming to bathe in the spa. You go, oh yeah, this man understood psychology. But there's a sudden point where one of the characters turns to another and he says, so you're talking to me about the rule of the majority, democracy. Tell me, who make up the majority, the wise or the fools? And he's sort of, I don't want that thought. I don't like that thought at all. But until we're able to participate, until we between us know what the words mean, you know, and have some sense of where we're going, we can't actually have democracy. We'll have these cacocracies, the rule of the worst, plutocracies in the US and much of the rest of the world, the rule of the wealthy, where, you know, when John Kerry was standing for president, that's a long time ago, he had a marquee. And to go into the marquee and shake his hand, you had to put $100,000 in the box. And I'm going, and this is a democracy, where the lobbyists are actually determining what we do, looking at what the tobacco industry and the oil industry managed to get governments to do just by withholding money. Instead of going, there's got to be a balance where pro-social people, people who actually want benefit for humanity, can govern. Mm-hmm. And that brings us right back round to your starting point, which is fear.
Yeah. But
authoritarianism triumphs when men of good do nothing, to misquote Edmund Burke, that because we don't know what to do and we don't know how to do anything, because they've tightened this process up so much that the only, I do see two hopes. One is virtual Taiwan, where
virtual Taiwan, I'm not familiar with that, yeah.
They have the first transgender minister of any government in the world, bless them for that. And she basically went, well, we've got this problem with electric scooters. Half our population don't want them, half do. What are we going to do? We need to move to a supermajority. We need to get at least two-thirds of the people voting one way or other. Why don't we discuss the issues online? Why don't you want to have scooters? Why do you want to have scooters? Well, they're dangerous. They could hit people. Oh, speed restriction. Okay. The people on them could get hurt. Oh, helmets. And elbow pads, maybe. And they negotiated a deal. And you go, oh, God, that's so simple. Why isn't anywhere else doing it? That when we come up against a problem, why don't we have public debate now? Why don't we exercise democracy and keep voting on the micro issues until we reach agreement? So,
which in the same way is how you could deal with AI. AI is clearly an issue of it needs restrictions. Mm. You know, so in that sense, there are people, you know, like you had said yourself, you know, there are certain fears, you know, legitimate fears around, you know, what this thing could and possibly can do. So then you have to restrict those, you know, extreme situations. And that is where the debate should be is, well, what are the potential dangers? And obviously there's a lot, when you're dealing with new technology, there's a lot of unknowns, and that is one of the fears. Like, we don't know what it's going to do, right? So there's got to be an operating model that, as things emerge, we compensate and recognize, well, this isn't very good, we need to stop it from doing that, or that needs to be the kind of work in progress. But I think what you're describing, you know, again, that is just engaging logic and critical thinking and how to deal with the problem, rather than to make these massive sweeping statements that just terrifies people to the point where they can't think. Mm-hmm. And they're like, just tell me what to do then. Just tell me what to do. And then I don't trust the people in position of power to make very, very healthy decisions for the rest of us. I'm sorry, but I just don't trust that to kind of unfold that way.
And they have not generally proved to be trustworthy. I think that after every war, there should be a war crimes trial for both sides. There were certainly war crimes committed by the Allies during World War II. You know, at the end of World War II, the British set up two camps for denazification. One was Wilton Park here in the UK, and they did incredible work. They got Nazis to talk about what they believed and to deconstruct their own beliefs and go, oh my God, you know, why did I believe that? By not being oppositional, by allowing them. But they had another camp in Germany where they tortured people. British Army tortured people to make them change their minds about being Nazis. And you go, well, that probably wouldn't work very well. You know, we'll do these Nazi things to you until you're not a Nazi. You know? I think there is another hope, and it's possibly not thought about enough, that a few years ago, within 12 months, a political party came into being and took power in France. Now, I'm not a fan of Macron, which is it's a little mark that's used in writing, a Macron. Did you know that? He's an economist. Yeah. I'm not particularly keen on the man. And I'm not particularly keen on his party, En Marche. But they took complete control of France away from the existing parties. So that one of the 10 largest economies in the world and one of the most developed countries is able to do that. And they're in a roiling mess at the moment, as usual, but it shows that it can be done, and that the barrier to that is, with free advertising or social media, as it's also called, we might be able to switch from this situation in the United States where, to become the man of the people, the president or the woman of the people, you need $1 billion, $1,000 million to even make a start. And that can't be democracy. What we want is people who are competent at doing the job, and we need to rethink our very much 19th century political systems. I mean, the electoral colleges in the US, come on, guys, you know, let's grow up. That this doesn't apply today. But we can change our information systems if we could use AI to actually hunt down useful information and share it and help in teaching. There was a really strange experiment that was carried out in India And the guy became a professor here at Newcastle University later. But what he did was, he said, I wonder what would happen if I put some computer terminals in a village and let the kids play on them. And they seemed to start educating themselves. So he then did a thing where he got four kids together with a computer and four kids together with a teacher and a computer. And he found that the four kids with the computer without the teacher learned faster.
Wow.
And he's done a lot of work since then. So there are ways of getting information into society that take the authoritarian steps out of the way. There are teachers who can facilitate learning as well. And they are the best of teachers and perhaps the most important people in society, though we don't pay them properly. But de-routinizing, you know, changing the way that, that we look at situations. And as you say, when somebody's trying to scare the living daylights out of us, stopping and going, what is the real threat? And what is the initiative? You know, is a cigarette actually a nicotine delivery system? Am I thinking about this the right way? You know, let's put menthol in, that'll make it more addictive. That we have to encourage, not simply, you know, developing AI and letting it take over. We have to encourage some human intelligence. It's about time, isn't it, really? That, you know, instead of the cancel culture and postmodernism and all of these stupid notions which seem to come out of the death of philosophy and the inability to think, you know?
That's right. And I think it's also recognizing that when that fear was, when you were experiencing that fear response, to hopefully catch yourself and say, hold on, why am I feeling this way? What is, you know, is there potentially an agenda happening for that's evoking this response? Should this give me cause or pause to look at, you know, that perhaps some manipulation is going on? Like, don't just react. Allow the reaction to trigger some form of thinking, you know, critical thinking on some level, to say, hold on, I know this. I know this feeling. I know this is not healthy. I know in this state, I don't think, you know, I don't perform at my best. Maybe I need to pull back, relax, and consider there's maybe some manipulation going on some level. There's some sort of influence occurring, and there may be someone who's got an agenda here, and start to kind of recognize the response as being the trigger to start thinking, rather than to just have the reaction and let me say, tell me what to do. I'm terrified. I'm panicking. Like you said earlier, I think that's that we need to rethink this whole thing and recognize that. And it's obviously in certain situations, you know, if someone's coming at you with a gun, yeah, the fear response is great. But when we're just on a daily basis being exposed to things through the media, through, you know, whether, you know, it's the news or whatever that evokes that response, recognize that potentially manipulation is happening.
And withdraw from the source of the information. Don't immerse further in the information. Take it off on your own.
Right.
Talk to people you know and trust. Look things up on the internet, accepting that search engine optimization has now completely destroyed the adequacy of search engines. But apparently you can buy any disease you want at Amazon. That will be your first result, which is good to know. Withdraw from the situation of influence. And if you're reading something that is scaring you, take it piece by piece, analyze it, look at the one idea at a time rather than the flood of terrifying ideas. And because it is very easy to scare people, we are very easily scared. And that can sometimes lead to, you know, putting up the blinders and ignoring what we've been told. And that's not a good idea either. The thing is to withdraw and to consider. And, you know, it could be, if you have the chance, if it's not a rhinoceros charging at you as we go, in which case, jump to one side would be my recommendation, because they have trouble turning because they're quite big.
Good. You know, and I think the other side of the coin is recognizing that flattery, and you know, is another, you know, side, like that's another trigger to say, oh, hold on, like I think if someone had told me at a very young age that if someone excessively flatters you in the sense that, you know, feeling good too fast should be a warning sign, rather than, you know, if someone kind of tells you how great you are, all the things you wish your parents, you know, can never say enough times, you know, they love you, they think you're special, they think you're unique. If someone, you know, this is what we call the love bombing, right? You know, like, you know, you've got this fear response, and then you've got this love bombing thing, and they're actually just two sides of the same coin, just trying to manipulate. And I think, you know, if we can start to see paradigms from this perspective of these responses we get, and rather than feel we act on the response, let the response be the trigger to say, oh, I think there's potentially, I need to be cautious and say there might be a form of manipulation or influence occurring at this moment. And let me take pause and consider it from that lens, which will generally allow you not to be immersed in that emotional state, whether it's fearful one or one of flattery or adulation, all that sort of stuff. And I think we'd all be better off, you know, to some degree if that was taught to us at 13 or something like that. You know?
These things do seem ridiculously simple, but when somebody comes up to you that you don't know and they're telling you how wonderful you are.
Right.
Which of course in your case, Hoyt, is true. then you should be, you know, the next question should be, with a smile, what are you selling?
Right, exactly. Right. You know? Yeah.
And can I help you? Because you're probably in trouble. You know, are you in multi-level marketing Jehovah's Witnesses? What is it you're selling?
Yeah.
And even there, what recruiters are selling is their own desperation. I think Glenn Ross is still, what an incredible thing, watching Jack Lemmon upstage everybody. What an incredible actor he was. You know, he's got Kevin Spacey, who's now on trial here in England.
Right, exactly.
And Al Pacino in the pack. But seeing the emotional manipulations that Jack Lemmon and the other salespeople go through to get that sale, that they're willing to do anything to get that sale. And the same is true for a Mooney recruiter or anybody else.
And again, that driven by the fear of not getting it, that those sales and what that would mean, right? You know, again, because they're being manipulated in that way, that if you don't create the numbers, you are lesser than, you are diminished, you are a failure, yada, yada, yada. You know, all methods of manipulation.
And of course, you know, it gets pretty severe with the Moonies if you fail to sell enough wilted flowers or whatever is, you know, it's guns at the moment they seem to be selling, then not only are you damned, but all of your ancestors are damned. Now, I don't think they've ever actually done the calculation of that, because the point is that generation by generation, if all of my ancestors are damned, just me, then all of yours are. Because when we go back, you know, a few hundred generations, I'm afraid they're the same people. You'd have to go that far to find relationship. But that thought, you know, or with Jehovah's Witnesses, that Armageddon is it's going to happen in 1914, 1917, 1919, 1923, 1934. I believe it. It did happen.
And it's your fault, you know? Why it's... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had... it's wonderful. Nora Beth Crest, ex-Scientologist who spoke at the Toronto thing I did in 2015, Getting Clear of Scientology. And she said that she'd asked for a day off, and they'd said millions of people will, you know, be affected by, you know, do you have no care or concern for humanity that you want to go and eat ice cream? You know, the fanaticism, the fervor, the drive, which is terrifying, you know, and the thought that if you leave, of course, you know, and I don't know why it's always this expression. My wife and I have been talking about this recently. You could be hit by a bus. You could be run over by a bus. I don't know why buses are the most dangerous thing. An elephant could drop out of the sky on you. But there is, you know, my friend Christian Jerko had a client who couldn't leave the group because she'd been told that she'd be run down and she couldn't get off the block. She didn't dare cross the road.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Because that was written in, you know.
When I was in my group and contemplating leaving because things had gotten so intense, and it was never from the point of view that I never got to the realization that there was abuse happening and something that was going on around me was unhealthy. I was so convinced it was always my fault, you know, and that I had come up short and I was lesser than, and there were so many things wrong with me, and I was brain damage and all these things. But even when I considered, like, it was just too much and I needed to leave, the thing that always would stop me going down that path was saying, well, I would be okay with if this just meant I was screwing up my own life. Like, then I could leave. But I've been brainwashed into thinking, you know, it's not like Scientology with their billion-year contract. Like I had taken incarnations and arrived in this lifetime. This is part of the program that I went through, you know, that now I had this chance in this lifetime that I could put things right and basically be able to graduate out of the karmic wheel. I don't have to reincarnate again. Like if I get my shit together and really do it well this time, you know, I'm going to arrive at this place and I'll be able to not only take myself out of that karmic wheel, but I'll be in a position of leadership where I will be a benefit to millions, right? So all that ego stuff, like I'm going to do this important role. But the idea of saying no to that, and I'm now going to go off and just literally walk out the door and probably get hit by a truck because I've turned my back on God, right? You know, all that being the mentality. Like, the reason I couldn't was not so much because of what would happen to me, but this idea that I would now be karmically responsible for all those millions of people that I was supposed to help in this lifetime. That, I'm like, I don't want to be that guy. I can't be that. And that kept me digging in and trying to make it work, even though it clearly was abusive. It clearly was destructive. You know, that way of thinking and that fear was one that just kept me engulfed in the abuse and the trauma. And so it's like, I know that that's not a good thing to do now.
Yeah. And I mean, I can look back over the last 40 years and, you know, who's going to count it, but thousands of people are not involved in Scientology because I left.
You know? Right.
So in fact, there was some truth in the influence that we can have, but it was the opposite of what we were told. Hubbard, of course, says the whole agonized future of every man, woman and child on this planet depends on what we do here and now in Scientology. And I've always sort of gone, why is it going to be agonized then? You know, the whole agonized future. Well, the whole really nice future of humanity will be based on what we do now. Oh, I see. He was telling the truth. You know, it's going to be awful if we do what he said. So phobia induction. And
here we go.
Not a good thing. I think
not a good thing. But this is always fun, and I really appreciate these conversations. And
me too.
I learned so much from you, and just kind of, you know, the way that we just kind of dive into stuff and kind of let it unfold. And it's just interesting because I think these are conversations that are helpful for all of us to have, but it's got to come from this place of understanding, which I wish happened in school, and I wish you didn't have to go through things like you and I did to get to this point to have this perspective, right? It's like, it's just wild how it ends up playing into, you know, because I think for me at this point, you know, I'm looking at, like, I love these type of conversations that you and I can have, because it's really based on both of us kind of understanding and knowing each other's history, and knowing that these perspectives that we have are based on these histories. I find it's challenging when I'm meeting someone new and they're curious about my perspective, And then I can, you know, you get into the story of how you came to that perspective, and that story uses up everybody's bandwidth, and you don't get to really have the conversation you want to have. So I really treasure these conversations. Yeah, and
I know whereof you speak. I think it's important to me that it is the fact of conversation, the fact of discussion, that rather than, you know, Hoyt and John say, this is the way, the truth, right, and the life, and how you should, right, do things, that it's a stimulation to have conversations, to talk with people and chew things over. Because I think for me, certainly, and it's the thing I encourage in, you know, when people are talking about, you know, how do I get somebody out of a cult group? And it's like, well, have conversations with them. Get them to tell you why they're involved. Don't argue with them. Don't fight with them. Don't try and give them negative evidence, because that won't change their minds. You know, critical thinking only works when you can emotionally engage. And, you know, there is such a tendency to just tell people off for what they believe. And, right, you know, the righteousness that's built into that is just forget it, you know. But getting people to talk about something, I find that, you know, I can be quite convinced of some idea, and then I have a conversation with you or with one of my other friends, and realize that I haven't actually thought through all the stages of,
right, the, exactly.
And it's so helpful to have this environment where we can disagree, but we can do it agreeably. We, right, can explain why we believe something, and we can arrive at, you know, some wholesome conclusion from our discussion. And getting kids in school to do more of that, to follow Matthew Lipman and his ideas, which is not that you pour facts into children, but that you get children to think about the world and discuss it. Good idea. There's a little video called Socrates for Six-Year-Olds, and there's a very poor copy of it on YouTube somewhere, but that shows Lipman's ideas being given to 6-year-olds and 15-year-olds. And, you know, it's tremendously good for them, quite obviously, rather than, you know, having to sit in an overheated room and answer questions about what Shakespeare had for dinner or what have you, you know. It's not, you know. So debate, conversation, discussion is the vital aspect of any potentially democratic, non-authoritarian system, and we revel in it. What can I say?
Do we ever? My goodness. Well, good to see you as always, my brother.
Yes, always a pleasure. And we'll meet again.
We will. I'm looking forward to that, as always.
And right, and please, to anybody watching this, do add comments. Do correct us, yes, if we're wrong. Extend our thinking if you know more than we do, and we'll try and respond to that in some way.
Some timely fashion, exactly right.
Thank you so much, Hoyt. Always okay. Wonderful.
Good to see you, John. As always, take care, brother.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.